The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Master Dogen taught, the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. This is a teaching that goes back to the Buddha. So it comes from the very beginnings of our tradition. And I thought it would be nice to take this up again. It's familiar probably to many of you. I thought it would be nice to take this up again on this, the end of this weekend of Dana dinner, this time when we, for many, many years, would open the doors to local community who were not or did not have to be interested in Buddhism, but wanted to have some time in community with a meal, Santa Claus, some gifts. And so we started this lots of years ago and stopped doing it during COVID. During COVID, we would make the food and take it to various residences and centers in the area for people who might not have such a meal during holiday time. As I said yesterday, this holiday season is a time when there's a big expectation that everybody's happy and festive and with family or friends and just having a grand old time, but that's not actually true for a lot of people. Because of that expectation, that social, societal expectation, it can be just the opposite for a lot of folks. So it's just a time to, in a very simple way, just break some bread together. And so this teaching of the Buddha, Dogen has a fascicle, which he speaks of this. Bodhisattva's methods of guidance, another translation of this is the four means of attraction. How do we attract people? Some translations and teachings talk about this in terms of a bodhisattva or a teacher's attraction, means of attracting a student, bringing people to the Dharma. But let's look at this a little more broadly. Giving, kind speech, beneficial action, identity action. Soto school translation was identity action, was cooperation, which is kind of an interesting way of presenting it. So the first of these, giving, so in other words, how does a bodhisattva be in the world, guide, offer encouragement, inspire, make contact? With what? For what reason? Guiding people towards what? Attracting people to what? So it shouldn't be surprising that the first is giving, the first of the paramitas, Dana Paramita, giving a universal language, something that transcends language itself. Everybody understands giving. But when we give, it means we have to recognize we have something we can give. We have something to offer to another. Could be to insentient beings, could be to oneself. And in the same vein, it means that there's someone or something that could receive that offering. It could be another, it could be an insentient beings, it could be ourself. Not only receive, but also benefit from that. So implicit within this is that the giving is beneficial, is helpful. Otherwise, it's not giving. If we give something that's hurtful, that's not giving in this sense. And so to guide someone through giving or attract someone to the way, to the Dharma, to somebody else, to something positive, or just to diminish the distance that is necessary for us to create samsara, to give rise to dukkha, disappointment or greed or hostility, to just simply diminish the distance. You know, one of the wonderful things about the Buddha Dharma is that it speaks in such profound and sort of absolute terms that we all have the enlightened mind of the Buddha, the same mind, We can practice the Buddha's path as we are. We can realize enlightenment in our lifetime. We can do that. And so much of the teachings and the language is lofty, right? It's highly aspirational. It can seem out of reach if we misunderstand it and don't understand that it is to inspire, to help us to aspire, to help us to have that kind of confidence within ourselves. But that within all of that, that sort of very large view, there are so many teachings that are go along right alongside those teachings that are directing us towards enlightening our mind, that are very, that are based in the same truths, but that manifest in very simple, seemingly ordinary ways. Which means that at every point along the way, we can engage in Buddha Dharma, we can practice in ways that are real and transformative. So whatever is given with a good intention, clear intention, with skillfulness, can help someone. The teaching is that giving itself, the act of giving, is part of what is being given. Just the fact that you are giving in and of itself, aside from whatever you're giving, whatever the object may be, is part of what you're giving, just giving itself. And then the more pure the intention, the more skillful, the more selfless, we might say, the more in tune with what would be helpful to the other, the greater the guidance, the greater the attraction. And then not only does that offer something, a benefit, but doesn't it also engender trust? Doesn't it help to create a bond, even if it's with a stranger for a moment? And we never pass cross paths again, that it helps to bring forth trust. When the giving is free of the illusion of self, of the illusion that whatever we're giving has some intrinsic quality. And so there are many teachings about how simple, ordinary things can have great power in their giving. That the other person, the intention, the consequence, that all of those are empty of any intrinsic quality. That's Dhanaparamita, transcendent giving. But the Dharma also recognizes that even though that object has no inherent ability to make you happy or to bring you benefit, it does. Not intrinsically. It's not in the object, but there is something in the giving, the object is part of it, that brings forth a moment of some benefit, of happiness, of trust. And Buddhism recognizes that and says that's important too. So at the same time that we're on the path of ultimate happiness, we recognize that at every step along the way, we can practice, in a sense, temporary happinesses, smaller forms of happiness. And so giving can and does occur when there's no self-clinging and when there is self-clinging. There can still be giving. They're not the same, but they're not entirely different. They both have some, can have some benefit. And so we cultivate a mind of giving, the mind of giving, a mind of generosity, to be magnanimous, freeing our mind from all that binds it and kind of makes it small, makes it reluctant to give or to be generous. I mean, think about the practice of the Four Immeasurables. May all sentient beings be free of suffering, no happiness, sympathetic joy, equanimity. Each of those is an act of giving. When you visualize or hold someone or some ones in your mind and you invoke those with a heartfelt wish for those to go, to be offered to those, you're giving in your mind those qualities to that person or to those people. And think about how that person, let's say it's somebody who's anguished or in a deep state of sadness or distress, or somebody who is and doesn't know it, who's wielding a lot of power in a way that's hurting a lot of people. Think of how each of those qualities could begin to transform that person who wasn't acting out of suffering, who knew some had some sense of true happiness, who delighted in other people's benefit, who had some measure of equanimity, wasn't at the mercy of their own volatile emotions and those of others. When we give to somebody who isn't expecting it, isn't asking it for it, sometimes that can be a wonderful moment of giving because it wasn't expected. When I was living in the city for those 10 years at the temple, I felt like I witnessed that all the time. It's one of the wonderful things, because sometimes the city can seem, you know, a little tough. People going about their business, head down. And so in moments, the innumerable moments every day that happened there, I saw it when I was doing a lot of work in the prisons, going into prisons. I saw all kinds of moments of goodness, kindness, giving in a place, in a context where you wouldn't expect it, or you would think it wouldn't be happening. There it is. Dogen says, the causal efficacy of this giving penetrates even to the distant heavens and human realms, penetrates even to the worthies and sages who have verified the fruit, who know the truth of this. The reason for this is that the giving, becoming experience, becoming manifest, has formed a bond, a karmic bond, with those worthies and sages. The Buddha said, when a person who gives enters an assembly, people take notice. And so here it's talking about the power of giving that goes far beyond, you know, whatever may be happening in this moment. I offer this to you. That's maybe what I'm aware of. But what Dogen is saying is there's a whole causal efficacy that goes beyond what we might be able to see or ascertain or measure at that moment. This is why the Buddha said karma is so important to understand and have faith in karma. Because it's so far-reaching, it's so broad, it's so intricate and complex in its web of causation and how it moves in directions that we can't see, we can't know. Maybe ever, maybe just not now. And when we really trust that, then it gives us faith in being more generous and being more giving. Because there's a sense that, you know, what is happening in that moment has further consequences than we can know. I imagine it's hopefully what parents know in raising a child, what a teacher in a classroom knows, that you're aware of some of whatever's going on in the moment, but having sense, having been a child, having been a parent, or a student in a classroom, knowing that so many moments may see go by unrecognized, unknown by the student, by the teacher, by the parent, by the child, and yet launches, in a sense, plants a seed, in a sense, sets seeds to the wind. The reason for this is that the giving has formed a karmic bond. We create a karmic bond when we offer something. Again, sentient or insentient. In the same way that when we give fear or anger or hatred or distrust to somebody, we're creating a different kind of bond. Or when somebody does that to us. Dogen goes on to say, hard to change are the minds of living beings. You take some comfort in that. No, it's not just you. I mean, I have to imagine that every single student who's ever practiced sincerely has on different occasions thought, why is this so hard? Why can't I? Why does this keep arising again? Hard to change are the minds of living beings. Even when you're trying sincerely with some of the most powerful tools available. However, Dogen goes on, one seeks to change them though. Hard though it may be, one seeks to change them from beginning to change the mind ground with one possession as a start, one action, one moment, one step, until they reach gaining the way. In those, this is the Bodhisattva vow, to do whatever we can do in any moment. That's why Dana Dinner is so important, that it You know, I said yesterday, I said, as Buddhists, as practitioners, the Buddhism that you're bringing forth, you're not wearing on your sleeve, right? It's not in the language. That's why we specifically don't, we don't do the meal gatha. We don't bring Buddhist liturgy in, right? We let whatever we're creating as a sangha manifest, create a bond without saying a word about Buddhism. Although I did have a few words with people about Buddhism because they asked. That's okay too. One seeks to change them from beginning, to change the mind ground with one possession as a start until they reach gaining the way. There are times when the mind changes the object. There is giving in which the object changes the mind. This is the power of giving. The mind can transform the sense of what this object is and realize that it's something much larger, something that has more capacity than what it just appears to be. The giving, there's giving in which the object changes the mind. That very often can happen in giving something to someone. The object does change the mind. It impacts, it influences. Something happens with something as simple as giving. The next is kind speech, speaking agreeably. Dogen says, kind speech means that when you see sentient beings, you arouse the heart of compassion and offer words of loving care. It's contrary to cruel or violent speech. And of course, in order to speak with kindness, we must have some kindness within ourselves. See, there's the thing. It's moving inward and outward at the same time. Same as with the four immeasurables, which is kind speech. In order to bring forth a heartfelt wish for compassion, for loving kindness, and so on, there has to be some seed of that, some measure of that within myself. Even if at the same moment I am not feeling very compassionate, I don't feel very kind, I'm not sure that I'm delighting in your rewards and, you know, good fortune. But if I'm saying those words, I'm choosing to say those words, I want that. I want those qualities for you. And that means in some way I want those qualities with myself at the same time that I'm doubting it, which means they're already there. They already exist. It's moving in both directions. And so we have to work with those contrary forces. Whatever would keep me from offering kind speech, I have to work with those. Whatever those influences, forces, or attachments or views, whatever is going on inside of me that seems to make that difficult, hard, I resist. It feels like climbing a mountain. I have to meet that. That's the challenge of the Dharma. That's why I was talking to somebody yesterday and they were saying that, you know, they were very wary of religion and spirituality. And I said, I get that. I felt exactly the same way. And their partner said, I never talk about this with anybody. It feels very private. I said, I get that. I said, for 10 years, I meditated within the Zen tradition based on the one book that I had, and I never told anybody. One, because nobody was talking Buddhism at that point, at least nobody in my world. But it was also, it felt so personal. It felt so private. And I said, but you know, the great thing about Buddhism is Buddhism doesn't care about that stuff, really. It doesn't care what you call it. It doesn't have a stake in that. The only stake it has, if to even speak of it that way, is your well-being. And so we work with, if we engage the Dharma with any degree of sincerity, that means we are going to, we're saying, I am going to work with whatever, as I aspire to enlightenment or compassion or opening up my heart, that means by virtue of that, I must work with those contrary forces. That's the deal. We may not have known that when we first walked in. And so kind speech helps to bring that forth. The Buddha said intentional speech creates is a karmic action. which means it creates an effect that is based in morality, our character, our qualities, our virtues, not just a, you know, an action and a consequence out there in the void somewhere, but within us as a human being. And so even when we have unkindness within ourselves, we can still offer kind speech. Isn't that great? Right? You don't have to wait until you're completely feeling good and kind and compassionate. You don't have to wait. That's a good thing, right? Dogen says, in the Buddha way, there's the etiquette of asking if somebody's well or not. There are the words, take care of yourself. How are you? Speaking with the feeling, she thinks compassionately on living beings as if they were her babies. This is kind speech. Very simple, very ordinary. And creating a bond, affecting change that goes beyond what we can know. Simple words have influence on our mind and the minds of others. This is what the Buddha realized. This is why he put so much emphasis on language and speech. And in order to do that, as I said, we have to make room within ourselves. In a sense, we have to become larger, because within self-grasping, within, you know, a lot of the kind of negative emotions and thought patterns we have, those are sort of by their nature constricting. It's almost like they have a kind of defensive quality to pull in, to protect, to defend against, to recognize the threat, the enemy. And when we begin to transform those constrictions have to give way. They have to begin to yield. We have to make room within ourselves. If I am not feeling compassionate, but I bring forth the desire to bring forth compassion, that means I have to become a little bit larger within myself to be able to do that, to be able to just say those words. I have to become less attached to that particular mental or emotional state, that mood, that resentment, whatever. It's still there, but I have to be a little bit less invested in that. Teaching say, praise those with virtue, pity those without it. Encourage the good in others and have compassion for those acting badly, which doesn't mean be blind or complacent to bad actions. Of course not. It's just that the Bodhisattva vow really wants everyone to be free of suffering. If kind speech is offered little by little, kind speech expands, Dogen says. Thus, even kind speech that is not ordinarily known or seen comes into being. It evolves, it develops, it becomes more. And so he says, be willing to practice it for this entire present life. In a sense, see for yourself. Do not give it up. World after world, life after life. He's really talking about these sort of infinite possibilities with something as simple as kind speech. Offered little by little, kind speech expands. Does that mean the kindness expands? The expression expands? The different possibilities of how to express kindness expands? Our capacity for that expands? Yes, to all. This path is not linear. You know, I think we see that in the Zen tradition, where much of the linear way in which the Dharma was presented in the Indian tradition, because it was efficacious. It laid things out. It was kind of easy to remember. Like, so Buddhism is famous for its lists. In the Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism, which is huge, there's a huge section at the end, which is just the reference section of lists. The twos, the threes, the fours, the fives, the sixes. It's a great teaching tool, right? It's a way to like the four methods of the Bodhisattva. It's helpful to remember. And then when we remember, then we can call it to mind. We can bring it into our practice. So the Bodhisattva path is not linear. One action. So we need to think not just in terms of one action yields one result, which is often the way we think of it. And if we don't see that one result, then it seems like the action wasn't effective. And the teachings are saying, no, that's not true. That's why intention and skillfulness is so important. Think of how when you've had pain in one part of your body, a persistent pain, and how it shows up in different parts of the body. But it's actually localized in one part of your body. So why is the rest of your body manifesting in different ways according to that? Because it's one body. And so too with healing. You know, years ago, when I sat with a huge amount of tension, because that's just kind of the way I did everything, maybe that still shows up. Maybe you can see that in me. That was my way. That was how I knew I was applying myself. That's how I knew I was working hard. No pain, no gain. I didn't say that because I didn't like to live by cliches, but it was sort of my MO, right? And I kept applying that, and it's just, well, if I'm not getting the desired result, that means I'm just not applying enough force. More, more, more. Until I got to the point where I thought, I could ruin this. I could ruin my spirit, my desire to practice, my body. And I had some experiences that sort of made that real for me within myself and with some people close to me, and it scared me. And so I started to really focus. I thought, okay, I have to shift. It's not just more. That's not working. So I have to shift and start working in a different way. So I really was very conscious about trying to bring some relaxation into my body, which just felt wrong in 10 kind of ways. Because it wasn't familiar. I wasn't used to that. Those weren't the signs that I'd relied on to show me that I was working hard. So I thought, you can't trust that. Don't trust that. When my mind would say, you're being lazy, you're being complacent, I would think, I'm not really a lazy person. Maybe I don't have to worry about that. I was trying to, how do I cultivate trust in doing something that feels so wrong? And I just kept doing that because basically I wanted to sit without feeling like I was in a train wreck, physically, mentally, emotionally. But what I didn't expect was all of the ways in which that would start to show up in all different kinds of ways in my mind, in my meditation, in my practice, in my life. It's one body. It's not linear. That's why it's so important for us not to get so hung up on the results of an action. Of course, we're not blind to it. It's part of what helps us to guide ourselves in our practice, but to not put too much into that. Dogen says, kind speech is fundamental to overcoming enemies, angry, spiteful, hateful, and creating harmony among the virtuous. Those who hear kind speech from you will have a delightful expression and a joyful mind. To hear of kind speech indirectly inscribes it on one's being, inscribes it on one's spirit. So you might be thinking, well, what have you not been doing right, such that when you offer kind speech, you aren't met with a delightful expression and a joyful mind? It often seems like those who are deep within their own unhappiness, anger, hatred, do not hear, cannot hear something as simple as kind words. But no one can keep us from offering those words. No one can prevent us from offering that gift. They may or may not seem to receive it, but a message has been sent. That's part of the karmic bond. A message has been sent. It has been heard. It may take time for it to be received. That's why Buddhism has the long view. You may never see that message has been received. That's why the teaching of rebirth is important in Buddhism. But however, the Bodhisattva's kind words are not dependent on getting a desired result. They're not ignorant of results, because that's part of what's helping us to see, was that skillful? Was that helpful? What might be more helpful? But it's not dependent on it. Know that kind speech arises from kind heart, and this from the seed of compassion. Ponder the fact that kind speech is not just praising the merit of others, it has the power to turn the destiny of a nation. Is that why people within religious traditions have historically so often been at the vanguard of change, positive change? Beneficial acts, the third of the methods of guidance, means using skillful means to benefit living beings, high or low, easy or difficult. For example, looking to the near and distant future, we carry out expedient acts to benefit others. But what if you don't believe in causation? What if you don't have faith, right, that an action might bear fruit later? You might never see it. What if you don't have faith in that? What if you don't see any positive result of beneficial actions? Why bother? Well, my question would be, can you be completely sure? You may not be able to prove that it isn't having a beneficial effect, but can you prove that it's not? Then, now what? What might be a better way to live? What might be a better way to be with others, to meet? Can we ever know what stirs in the heart of another, really? Consciously or even beneath their conscious? Have you ever seen kind words or beneficial action directed towards yourself seem to not land at all in the moment, but bear fruit later? I bet you have. We don't know. There's so much we don't know. But rather than just getting stuck in that, it's understanding the nature of karma. I've read that cognitive science says that most of our real inner movements, most of what's actually going on within us, our decisions, consequential mental and emotional actions, forming, all are taking place beneath our consciousness. And then a certain moments arise and we think, oh, I did that. I thought that. I made that decision. I willfully, in a linear way, brought myself to that. And what I've read in cognitive science is that's not actually what's going on. Most of it's happening beneath our awareness. But of course, what we're doing with our conscious awareness has a lot to do with how that's working. Dogen says, foolish people think that if they give priority to benefiting others, their own benefit will be excluded. This is not true. We should benefit both friend and enemy, self and others alike. If you have this heart, even beneficial action for the sake of trees and grass and wind and water is spontaneous and unremitting. And so make a wholehearted effort to help all that you meet. Actualize good for others. To love the earth. To love the sentient beings, the insentient beings. The wind, the water, the seasons. To just be of love, of caring. All the complex webs of mutual dependence. And then lastly, identity action means non-difference. Non-difference from self, non-difference from others. For example, in the human world, the Buddha took the form of a human being. From this, we know that he did the same in other realms. When we know identity action, self and others are one. From a relative's perspective, we all feel pain and pleasure. Right? We all know what hunger and thirst feel like. Everyone really ultimately wants to be part of something, feel like their life belongs and matters and is larger, that we have something to offer. From the absolute ground of being, every wave is just ocean water. Sameness, non-difference, rising and falling, but the same. All dharmas arise as forms of emptiness, non-difference. In the Soto Shu translation, translating identity action as cooperation, it comes down to the same thing. He says cooperation means not differing from self, not differing from others. And the footnote to that says, the thing I like about that translation is the footnotes are very honest, and they sometimes say, in effect, this is kind of a terrible translation, but we didn't know what else to do with it because it's so complex, what Dogen is doing. And so here he says, cooperation means not differing kind of obscures Dogen's interpretation. Cooperation is more literally the same thing, as in the Tathagata's being the same as those in whatever realm he appears. It's trying to use language, subject and object, this and that, to express something which is non-different. And so the precept to see the perfection, not speak of others' errors and faults, to realize self and others one, to not elevate the self and blame others. These precepts show us how we act on our false sense of difference or non-cooperation and how to be more clear. So then how do we observe or are hurt by those that are not cooperating, that are not living identity action, who have no sense of identity action, who have seemed to deeply have a sense of non-difference, of difference, absolute difference, high and low? How do we hold them in our minds and hearts? How do we meet them? The precepts say, well, first, as much as possible, just don't speak of others' errors and faults. Don't hold an awakened being as higher than a deluded being. When necessary, to speak of others' errors and faults, because it would be skillful, it would be unskillful not to, not compassionate. Do so with a mind that wants to alleviate suffering, not create more. When the mind that isn't hateful, that isn't based in ill will, isn't wanting to cause harm. From the Bodhidharma one mind perspective, self nature is wondrous. All things are non-difference. And so Dogen says, in the midst of the Buddha Dharma, we are the same way, the same Dharma, the same realization, the same practice. And so we have to have these different ways of looking at, understanding, responding in different moments. Dogen quotes an old teaching that says, the ocean doesn't reject water, that's why it's so large. The mountain doesn't reject earth, that's why it's so high. A wise ruler does not despise people, that's why they have many trusting citizens. Well, how is it when the ruler's not wise? When they're actively rejecting and despising many of the people that they have responsibility for, how is it when they're not trusted by the people? What then? What methods of guidance or traction does a bodhisattva employ now? Giving, kind speech, beneficial actions, identity action. At such a time, they're even more important. And this is not about just having a dogma, a fixed doctrine that you apply equally at all times and all circumstances, no matter what. It's not that. I mean, that's what the teachings make abundantly clear all the time. That's why upaya, skillfulness, is so important. What that's communicating is you can't just apply a rule. But the basic principles of how to be peaceful and liberate ourselves from suffering within ourselves and between ourselves, those things don't change. Because we're the same. And we're the same no matter where we are, no matter when we are. But how we bring those things forth will have to change according to time and place. Jim and I started rewatching the Civil War documentary by Ken Burns. And we were talking about, we just finished watching the Revolutionary War. We're working our way through the wars. And she asked me, she said, if you had to go to war to save the country, would you? Fair question. If you had to go to war to save the country, would you? Would I? And I thought about it for a little bit. And I didn't say this exactly, but I thought later, as a person of a vow who's committed to this life and to these teachings, because I believe deeply in my heart they are true all the time, in every circumstance. And because of my lacking in trust and motives and reasons for going to war, and of my insufficient trust in the skillfulness of war to bring about true peace and resolution, I don't think so. I try and avoid absolute declarative statements that predict the future that I don't know. But just to think about conflict based in greed and anger and confusion and hatred and fear, which have to be part of war and conflict, that means taking rather than giving, speaking hatefully rather than kind words, hurting, creating violence rather than beneficial action, manufacturing and increasing division and trust rather than cooperation. Do I want to stand behind that flag? Do I want to put my, not just my life, but my commitment to what I want this life to be, what I want our lives to be, behind that banner? But what about a just war? So we were watching the Civil War. So it seems like the Civil War needed to happen to end slavery. Seems like that. Of course, slavery had to end, and it did end the institution of enslaving people. Made that illegal? Did it also extinguish the hatred and the violence in the minds and hearts? Did it make compassion and kind the hearts and minds of the enslavers? Has this country stopped struggling with that because of that war? Have we resolved or even sort of diminished beyond our easy ability to see our division making, fear-mongering, objectifying, making, false accusing actions, words that are expressly designed to exclude and reject and frighten and subjugate the very same people that the Civil War was fought for? Did the Civil War heal those deep national sicknesses? Hard to change the minds of living beings. How, and yet, the teaching says, do not stop trying to change the minds of living beings. Be skillful in every effort to change the minds of living beings. And of course, ground zero is you and me. You within your own mind, me within my mind. That's where we're fundamentally learning. And then we take it out. In the midst of afflictive emotions and impulsive consciousness and habitual tendencies, everything that Buddhism has been teaching since the time of the Buddha, false views, our attachments within ourselves, in the midst of others, it can seem easier or even right to respond in kind. And that is the great challenge. It's pretty easy to see how that just is sickness added to sickness. But to offer, to sort of hold, be stable, right? Know our mind. Know what's true and what's not true. Have a long view, which can be extremely challenging when the house is on fire. So these vows, we are not easy. Right? We didn't greet you at the door. None of us was greeted at the door and says, come on in. This is going to be such a piece of cake for you. Right? Quite the opposite. What the teachings say from the very beginning is, buckle down. It can be a difficult journey, but it's true. It's a true journey. These vows don't fix or eradicate every illness before our eyes. We have to do that. But we also have to think about it differently. Fixing, eradicating, being done with it. So they don't do that, but they are a path of peace, of enlightened vision, of universal compassion, of loving kindness. And that's why the Buddha said, essentially, to the vows, to the teachings, to the practice. He basically said, try them on. See what you find. And in moments of doubt, you know, what I used to think of in moments of doubt, off usually sitting right in this hall at the bottom of a pit that I had created and thrown myself in, oftentimes was dragging some of you in with me. And I would think, I don't know. I just don't know if I can do this. This is hard. I'm not sure I've made of the right stuff, whatever the hell that is. And then I would reflect on my life before I encountered the Dharma. I thought, no, that was hard. That was hard. This is not so hard. In one of the very early sutras of the Buddha, he said, generosity, kind words, beneficial help, and consistency in the face of events. Consistency in the face of events. In line with what's appropriate in every instance. These are the bonds of fellowship, friendship, kindness, that function in the world like the linchpin in a moving cart. That cart is you, that cart is us. These teachings are the linchpin. How fortunate are we?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.